Thanks for checking out a special episode of the New Mexico in Focus podcast this week. We usually don't cover sports on NMIF, but this year's Lobo basketball season isn't just any sports story. The team started the season hot, climbing into the top 25 nationally several times. Now, despite that success, the Lobos looked like they were cooked after a late season loss to Air Force. Not so fast, though. A little over 2 weeks later, the guys in cherry and silver claimed their first Mountain West championship and NCAA tournament berth in a decade. That's only to be bounced in a first-round blowout by Clemson. As Albuquerque Journal sports writer Jeff Grammer tells me, it was a quintessential experience for a uniquely New Mexican fan base. Jeff Grammer, thanks for being here on New Mexico in Focus.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's isotope season now. We know that. That means you're going to be pulling for Taco at the in-between inning races. I know that.
Absolutely. There's also baseball games that go on. It's not just the chili races, but absolutely. Big Taco fan.
Absolutely. What's not to love? But I want to look back at Lobo basketball.
Yep.
So, first tournament appearance in about a decade. Mountain West championship. How much fun was this season for fans?
I'll tell you what. I'm a whole lot better reporter when they're winning than when they're losing, so I think fans had a much better time because they were a lot nicer to me this year in following my stories. I do think that fans sort of saw this building for a three-year period, right? I think Richard Pitino hired 3 years ago this month, in fact. I think people kind of, you get sold a bill of goods sometimes, like, okay, the coach is going to rebuild this thing and it's going to take a little while, but be patient. When it actually works out that way and they go from, you know, 13 wins to 22 wins to 26 wins like they did and make the tournament and it's kind of building the whole time, I think the buildup for the enjoyment had kind of been a three-year process, really a decade-long process, because Lobo fans, I think, expected NCAA tournaments, if not every year, probably three out of every 4 years, certainly not one in a decade. So I think Lobo fans really enjoyed this, but I also think it goes back to even before just this season. I think the buildup is sort of the ones who are on board for 3 years in this rebuild, I think, really enjoyed this year.
Yeah. How much fun was it for you? I mean, after so many down years, the success this year.
The vibe is certainly a lot better, right? I mean, I'm getting paid to cover a basketball game, whether they win or lose. And so there's not a whole lot of complaining I can do or should do. If I do, I certainly get reminded, oh, yeah, you just got paid to watch basketball, right? So I love my job, whether they win or lose. But the vibe around it, people are just happier. And when people are a little happier around the program you're covering, yeah, it's probably just a little bit more fun. What I like about it is it had been 10 years and probably 7 or 8 of them were of the same kind of theme. It was, you know, players that weren't achieving what maybe fans thought they were going to. And there was a lot of underachieving. There was off the court distractions. There was off the court drama. It was just nice for a couple of years to cover a group of players weren't getting in trouble off the court and they were winning and they were building towards something. It was a nice change of pace.
Yeah. Nice to see you getting some love in the national press, too, on this run.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Speaking of your coverage, though, your story on Nelly Jr. Yeah. Joseph really blew up. What was it like reporting that story out?
Fun, right? Like, those are the stories. I'd actually started 2 months ago. It wasn't really meant to be an NCAA tournament March Madness kind of story. I started it in early January, and I'd reached out to there was a player here 3 years ago under Paul Weir. Kurt Wegscheider was his name. He played in NBA Africa. So I had a contact at NBA Africa. It's an academy that basically finds prospects around the continent, and they bring him to this academy. It's now in Senegal. I forget where it was prior, but anyway, now it's in Senegal. And they bring these prospects, and the goal is twofold. One is to grow the sport outside of the United States, which leads to marketability and money, but it's also to find prospects and bring them into the NBA and maybe grow the sport with, you know, the best talent in the world. That's the goal of a major sport. So this NBA Africa Academy that I had a contact with had identified Nelly Jr. Joseph in Nigeria when he was – really his journey started when he was about 13. He was living – at the time, his father died when he was really young, before he was too old to remember. His mother is alive, but wasn't really part of the family. He lived with a grandmother who had died when he was 10 or 11. He had been living in her home for a few years by himself. So you can't say he was homeless per se, but he'd wake up in the morning and he'd walk the streets looking for food and playing soccer with his friends, finding odd jobs to pay for the food. And people always saw him, really tall kid playing soccer, said, why don't you play basketball? He said, I have no interest. Finally, he was convinced to go try this basketball thing. One thing, kind of one unique step leads to the next, and then he ends up in this NBA Africa Academy, plays for Rick Pitino at Iona, and Rick Pitino takes the St. John's job this past offseason, and Nelly Jr. Joseph said, you know, I'm going to try a bigger conference, a bigger level of basketball, and transferred to New Mexico. And here he is. It was a fun story because not only is Nelly Jr. Joseph, while a little bit hard to understand in the interview necessarily, he has a great story to tell and loves telling it. Not only that, but like he's also a really good basketball player, which does lend itself to a certain, I guess, appeal when you're writing about basketball and about a team and a fan base that wants to read these stories.
For sure. Yeah, I really enjoyed that one.
Thank you.
Now, we chatted last year when San Diego State made it all the way to the national final.
Yeah.
That was obviously a big deal. This year, a record 6 Mountain West teams made the tournament, but not so much success after that. Obviously, SDSU making it to the Sweet 16, that was the farthest. How does the conference view this season as in terms of a success or not? 6 teams versus early flameouts.
Yeah, obviously the talking point will be they'll spin it as a very positive. I don't see it as a huge negative per se because they did get 4 wins overall. Not one of their losses was to a team seeded below them, so they didn't get upset in anything. Now, they weren't happy with the seeds they got. UNM got an 11. 3 teams, Nevada, Colorado State, and Boise State, all got 10 seeds when they thought they'd be seeded in the 8 or 9 range, maybe even as high as 7. Utah State was an 8 seed that beat a 9 seed in TCU and then lost to the number 1 seed, Purdue. And then San Diego State, a 5 seed, they beat lower seeded teams, and they when they lost, it was to UConn, who's just a great team. So when you look at it in terms of a 4-6 record, you get the record 6 teams in, you're happy about that. 4-6 record in the NCAA tournament for a conference isn't awful necessarily, but you were really hoping this year would build on the momentum that the league had where they had these 6 teams in the top 30 and top 40 of the net rankings. So they wanted to do better for sure. They didn't really capitalize on that, but on paper, none of them were upsets. Could have done better, missed opportunity, but really probably wasn't a bad showing overall.
Sure. Now, what about money? We talked about that last year. Obviously, with SDSU making the championship, that meant some payouts for all the teams in the conference. What about this year with those 6 appearances but no long run?
Yeah, so last year's run by San Diego State created a record 8 unit shares. And what a unit share in the NCAA, CBS, Turner Sports has paid, you know, $3 billion or whatever it is to own the broadcast rights to the NCAA tournament. That, you know, multi-billion dollar payout is paid out to the schools, to the conferences actually around the country every year. And they're called unit shares. Every unit is an appearance in a game. So every game that a Mountain West school appears in, you get a unit. So right off the bat, you got 6 units in the Mountain West. That's good. I think their record before last year, I think, was 7, maybe it was 6 actually. And so this year, just getting 6 teams in, you're already right there at a pretty good year, but then you did get 4 wins. So last year, San Diego State making it all the way to the championship game, but the other 3 teams that got in all lost in their first game. That was a record 8 unit share year for the Lobo or for the Mountain West Conference. Then they distribute the money evenly over 11 teams. This year it was 10. A unit share is $343,000 this year. It is paid out over 6 years. Without getting any more into the weeds than I already have, essentially every team gets about $30,000 to $35,000 for every game that a Mountain West team appears in. UNM gets $30,000 every time San Diego State plays a game in the tournament, and that's paid out over 6 years. So, yeah, I think this year the Lobos and every other Mountain West school are probably going to be collecting close to $1 million from the Mountain West Conference, and that'll be growing actually because next year's will have the 8 units that this year or that yeah this last year got 8 units, this year got 10 units, and it keeps building like that. So over the next 6 years, and then when the COVID year drops off that had a 0, I think the Mountain West and teams like UNM are starting to get a whole lot more money. That's what the power conferences get. Like, it's an embarrassment of riches when you look at the Big 12 and the SEC. They're getting a ton of money, and they get 6, 7, 8, 9 teams in every year. Well, they keep making more money because of it, and now the Mountain West is getting a little bit of a taste of that.
Okay. Now, in terms of competing with those bigger conferences on the court, how much does UNM's, or and most of the Mountain West's, early season ease, I don't know if I want to call it, but they're not facing tough teams early in the season. What does that do for these rankings when the tournament time comes out? And do you see that changing anytime in the future?
I do. I see. So this year, the net rankings are the NCAA evaluation tool. NET is the NCAA evaluation tool. And then these net rankings were designed to try and put a value on games and opponents when there's 362 Division I teams, and you have to somehow whittle that down to a 68-team field. They obviously don't play each other, so how do you know really who's better other than just saying, oh, that team I think is better? So they came up with this evaluation tool, and the Mountain West did really good in the net rankings this year. UNM did really good. In fact, I think they're still in the 20s, 27th last I looked. Even as the NCAA tournament goes on, those are still a little bit fluid. So the Mountain West did great. But the problem is when the ACC only gets a traditional powerhouse conference only gets three schools in, and the Mountain West, or they got four schools in, the Pac-12 got three schools in, and the Mountain West is getting six schools in, these power conferences are like, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. So what they realized, and this year they're going to change in the offseason, is leagues like the Mountain West, teams like UNM, frankly, are guilty, if that's the right word, of playing lesser opponents in the non-conference schedule, but beating them by a lot. UNM was beating teams by 20 or 30 points fairly regularly back in November and December, but they weren't great teams. They weren't awful teams either, but the scoring component, the efficiency component that made it look like UNM was just this fantastic team because their efficiency numbers are great and they're beating teams by 20, probably overinflated the net rankings, is what the power conferences say. So they're going to adjust that moving forward. There is a more unified front among Mountain West teams, I think, to play a tougher non-conference schedule. And on that front, the UNM Lobos are finally in the best tournament they've been in probably 6, 7, 8 years. They're going to be playing in a tournament in Palm Springs that will have some power conference opportunities for them. Now, they have to win those games, of course. But the other nugget on that front that's worth noting is UNM, because football for so long hasn't really been making a whole lot of money in the athletic department, UNM's one of the few schools in the entire country that relies on its basketball team to generate revenue through its ticket money to pay for the whole athletic department. They budget for more than $3.5 million in ticket revenue every year, which is one of the highest in the Mountain West. And to do so, they have to play 18 home games. Well, power conference schools, good teams, aren't coming to the Pit to play. They don't have there's no reason for them to do so. So the Lobos kind of have to find whoever will come play in the Pit, and those aren't usually very good teams. So they're kind of in a tough spot. They have to help fund the athletic department. They can't go out on the road as much as other teams to play these good teams. So maybe that starts changing next year because the NCAA is looking at it. You have to play tougher opponents.
Yeah. Okay. That's an interesting consideration, the home games. I hadn't thought of that. When we talk about the early conference or early non-conference games influencing tournament placement, mm-hmm. How did UNM ended up with an 11 seed. I mean, the team beats SDSU, who ends up with a 5 seed, and then UNM's sitting there at 11 playing Clemson.
Yeah, and beat them twice. They played three times this year, and UNM was 2-1 against San Diego State. They were 2-1 against Colorado State, who made the tournament. 1-2 against the Boise State team that made the tournament, and 2-0 against Nevada. So they actually had a really good record within the conference of the teams that made the tournament. The problem was the selection committee really, frankly, and I'm not the only one saying this, but frankly, kind of disrespected, I think, the Mountain West and said all those good wins that these teams got within conference play were just against each other. They didn't do it in November, as we were talking about just a little while ago. They didn't do it in November against really good teams. They were just doing it against each other. So let's not even weigh those in as much as we normally would. The problem with that is that's what the Big Ten and the SEC and the Big 12 have been doing for years. They traditionally have played weak non-conference schedules, and then in league play say, well, every night's a really tough opponent, so that's what builds us up for the NCAA tournament. Well, the Mountain West did that this year, and then they kind of got punished for it. So it's a weird dynamic that the Mountain West finally got to the point that they were getting all these in-league games against NCAA tournament-worthy teams, but then they got punished for it. So the Mountain West would love to be in that same predicament next year, but I do think they're going to tweak the metrics a little bit. I was surprised that the Mountain West got seeded the way they did. As you said, New Mexico was an 11 seed. They wouldn't have been in had they not won the Mountain West tournament. And the selection chair committee said that, or the chairman of the committee said that. They won the Mountain West tournament 4 games in 4 days, beat 3 NCAA tournament teams in a row to do that. Colorado State, I think some people thought they were a 7 or 8 seed. They got a 10 seed and had to play a play-in game. Same with Boise State. So Mountain West didn't exactly get a whole lot of respect shown on Selection Sunday.
Yeah. Do you think that added to the chip on Lobo fans' shoulders?
Well, the chip on Lobo fans' shoulder is a very New Mexico chip. I think New Mexicans have a chip on their shoulder in general, and that's a proud state and a proud fan base. And yeah, I do think it added to it just a little bit. And while there is some satisfaction with just getting to the tournament for the first time in a decade and winning more games than you have in a decade, all those things, you can be happy with all that and still be pretty mad with how it ended up once it got to the tournament with the 21-point loss.
Yeah, and you know, being a Lobo fan, it comes with having high expectations, having those expectations drop. Then you see them win the Mountain West tournament and they're right back where they started.
Absolutely.
What are a few things that you've learned about the Lobo fan base, if you can expand on that a little bit?
The Lobo fan base is very New Mexico. I mean, there is a pride that they will fight with each other. They will fight with the players sometimes. They will say some things about the coaches. They will do all those things that a family does. They will fight with siblings like none other. But if anybody else, I'll tell you what, if a Nevada fan or a Boise State fan or a San Diego State fan says the exact same thing about a Lobo or about a Lobo fan, then it's on, right? Like that's the pride, that's the fighter state mentality of New Mexico. And I think it's very representative of the state as a whole. And I think New Mexico State has that as well down the road in Las Cruces. I think the Aggies have that for sure. The Aggies have it against the Lobos a lot more. I think the Lobos have more of a us against the world, while Aggie fans, and I went to New Mexico State, have a us against the world, but also us against the Lobos a little bit more than the Lobos have an us against the Aggies kind of thing. I think Lobo fans are just us against everybody.
Okay. Now, first time the teams made the NCAA tournament in a decade.
Yep.
Much of that is thanks to head coach Richard Pitino in just his third year. We know he's not going to Louisville, thanks to your reporting. Is he for sure sticking around, though, and for how long?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It's a fair question because he obviously now in two off seasons has talked with another team. Last year, the University of South Florida had offered him a $1.8 million contract to be their head coach. He has family in the Tampa area, which is why he listened to them. Ultimately turned down $1.8 million in a league that he didn't think was as good as the Mountain West and in a program that probably isn't consistently competing for championships like he believes New Mexico can within its league. So he came back, got paid $1.1 million. Again, turned down $1.8, came back to coach for $1.1 million and sort of said, look, you know, my family was there. There was a reason I listened, but I'm here. I love the fan base. He genuinely, I believe, still loves the fan base. I think he does love this program. But he, you know, when Louisville came calling and did reach out and just put a feeler out, and then they had a couple conversations, it's a place his family lived for 14 years, I think, or 16 years, rather. And he was an assistant there. His dad was a head coach there. It had some ties, and they were going to triple his salary. He's, from day one, not once lied about kind of like maybe a former coach, Steve Alford, did a little bit, where he was talking about, you don't mess with happy, we're so happy here. Sort of insinuated, if not flat out said, you know, we plan to be here for a long time and then left for UCLA. Richard Pitino hasn't done that. He's been pretty honest and upfront. He'll be here as long as this is the job that is as good as it is right now for him. But if a better job does come along, he hasn't been dishonest with people about that. He will listen. And if you can triple a man's salary and he has young kids, yeah, he's going to listen. So Louisville offered that opportunity, so he listened. I think in the long term, you know, you could probably expect this. Every year they have success, you could probably expect him to listen again.
Okay, so good news for now.
Good news for now.
Little bit of pessimism from me now.
Yeah.
If he were to leave the program, is that automatically a step back? And how concerned should Lobo fans be about how the team will look if and when they eventually do lose him?
Well, let's use this as an example. Had he left right now, you got two young players that are sort of foundational building blocks for the future. In an era where they're allowed to transfer at least one time, I think, frankly, you could transfer any year now and challenge it, but whatever. You can transfer at least once without sitting out. There's a one-time transfer rule that you can go wherever you want. So had he left right now, if you look around the country, any head coach leaving a program, the star players are leaving, either following that coach to where they go, or they're just testing the market, if you will. It's kind of a free agency thing. He himself, Richard Pitino himself, used that term. It's free agency for everybody now. Well, Donovan Dent's a sophomore going into his junior year. JT Toppin's a freshman up for a National Freshman of the Year award going into his sophomore year now. Those two guys are foundational building blocks that will make the Lobos, if they stayed like in the old days, if they stayed throughout their careers, the next 2 years, the Lobos would be considered among the league favorites only because of those two guys, and fill in a bunch of bums around them, and they'd probably still be considered some of the league favorites because of those two guys. Had Patino left, I imagine both of those guys not only probably would have left, they certainly would have had a full court press put on them from schools that can offer a lot of NIL money, which is name, image, and likeness. Players can make money now, and should, frankly. But they would have been offered an awful lot of money from some pretty good programs to come. They're still being offered money right now and being courted by these good programs, but whether you like it or not, the name of the game now is this NIL money, and the 505 Sports Venture Foundation, not that I'm giving a plug there, that just happens to be the local NIL collective for Lobo Sports, they were ahead of the curve 2 years ago. They're ahead of the curve now. Right now, I think it's them and UNLV in the Mountain West that have the most money to offer Lobo athletes, especially Lobo basketball. They're now stepping it up with football a little bit, to keep players like Donovan Dent and JT Toppin in Lobo uniforms. They're pretty confident that those two guys are coming back. Other guys that would be kind of picked off by good programs, or True Washington was a very good freshman on this team, and then some guys that didn't play too much, Quentin Webb, Braden Appelhans, both of those guys are players that I think will come back because the NIL collective at UNM is a pretty good one right now.
Okay, that's good to know. Despite that, though, Sebastian Forsling, Jamal Mashburn, yes, Jr., they did enter the transfer portal. What can the university do to keep players like Toppin and Dent from making that step?
So let me start with the Mashburn part of this. I think Mashburn, who's getting his degree, he's the first person in his family to get a degree, and did walk on senior night back in early March. Their final home game against Fresno State was their senior night, and he walked. And he did say, look, my dad is the senior in Jamal Mashburn Jr., very highly decorated All-American in college at Kentucky, NBA All-Star, had a very decorated basketball career. The one thing Jamal Mashburn Jr. was very proud to say he now has on his dad is a college degree. So he said, I got to start racking up these wins when I can get them. He now has that on his dad. His dad has a lot of other basketball accolades on him. But Mashburn Jr., I think once he got that degree, was probably headed this way for a couple months now. He has done 4 years of college. He does have a degree, and I think he will probably play professionally overseas as opposed to playing at another college. Now, he could play at another college. He and Sebastian, as odd couple as it may sound, this son of an NBA star from Miami named Jamal Mashburn Jr., who's been highly recruited throughout his career, and the seven-footer from Sweden who came over here, they're best friends, they're roommates. I'll bet you they end up, wherever they go, I'll bet you it'll be together. Whether it is at another college or whether it's overseas, I'll bet you they go together. And it's just a weird pairing, but they are best friends. I think they were, so I say all that to say, I think they were probably going to go anyway. It wasn't about trying to retain them in terms of a financial offering or anything like that. Jamal Mashburn Jr. actually didn't even take NIL money this year when it was offered. He could have had six figures and decided and declined. Just because he didn't need it. His dad is doing just fine, and his dad, who guides him in basketball, suggested he not take that money. To keep other players, the Donovan Dents, the JT Toppins, how Jalen House came back this year for a fifth year after he earned his degree a year ago, how he came back for that final year of eligibility, is because that NIL collective has raised enough money to offer, I don't want to say, competitive is probably the best term. It's not necessarily equal to what a Jalen House could have made overseas playing in Europe. He probably could have got a little more over there, but he was actually offered fairly competitive money to play one more year of college basketball. It feels so unlike what college athletics has been like forever, so it just feels maybe wrong to a lot of people. But maybe college athletics should have been this way once it became a multi-billion dollar industry, 20, 30 years ago. And the players now are starting to get some of that. I think a lot of people view it as they're just going to keep taking players away. But the NIL is about as retention as much as it is about recruiting. So I think UNM is in an okay spot relative to the Mountain West to be able to retain players like Donovan Dent and JT Toppin. But if you look at some of the top four teams in the country now, like a Houston, a UConn, a Purdue, if they come calling and want a Donovan Dent and they offer, $400,000 or $500,000 to play next year, he's going to have to consider it. He's an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid. You probably consider that.
Okay. Now, considering everything we just talked about, what is this setup for next year? Should fans be optimistic for another shot at the Mountain West title, maybe another berth in the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, let's play. You know, a few years ago, you look at a freshman on a team and a sophomore on a team and what's coming back. Let's assume it's all coming back, right? As of right now, nobody else is planning, or at least publicly, to enter the transfer portal. So based on that, if everybody on the roster right now comes back, the Lobos would probably be the preseason favorite to win the Mountain West next year with Donovan Dent and JT Toppin leading the way. You're probably looking at a true Washington as another starter. Nelly Jr. Joseph plans to come back for his final year of eligibility as well at the center spot. And then you probably move a Mustafa Amzeal, who plans to come back, at least for now, into the three spot. Like, you're looking at a five-man starting rotation for the Lobos that got extensive minutes this year. No other team in the Mountain West is going to have that. A lot of teams in the Mountain West are losing key players. Colorado State made the tournament, losing one of the best point guards in league history in Isaiah Stevens. Nevada, they're losing their two best players, Keenan Blackshear and Jared Lucas. Their two top scorers are gone. You're looking at a San Diego State, their best player, and third-team All-American, Jaden Ledee. He's gone. He's a senior. So everyone in the league is losing really, really key players, and the Lobos are too, and Jalen House and Jamal Mashburn Jr. But I don't think anyone else in the league is going to have five guys back that got extensive minutes like the Lobos. So if they're not a preseason pick to win the league, I don't see them being worse than second or third in the league in the preseason picks. And there's a reason for optimism, which also means reason for, you know, disappointment if they don't achieve what Lobo fans expect.
Understood. Jeff Grammer, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks to Jeff Grammer for that conversation. I had a lot of fun with it. If you follow the Lobos or the Isotopes, give him a follow on Twitter. We weren't kidding about his love for taco at the in-between innings races. Thanks for listening.